Three Frelimo troopers bolted out of their dugout as they saw them coming, and Sean fired the AKM from the hip, a short tap that caught one of them low in the back and flung him face down. The other, too, threw down their rifles and fell to their knees, gibbering with terror, hands held high over their heads. Sean ran on past them, and they collapsed with relief as he ignored them. Sean was through the outer defences and into the lager proper with its service areas and hardened helicopter emplacements. The workshops and fuel dumps were heavily sandbagged and covered with camouflage netting. Stray mortar shells were still falling amongst them, kicking up geysers of dust and gusts of whistling shrapnel. One of the hinds had fallen near the far perimeter of the lager and was burning fiercely, oily black smoke billowing back over the workshops. In the confusion, human figures scurried about without apparent purpose. Unarmed technicians in baggy grey overalls who flung up their arms when they saw Sean, most of them dropping onto their knees to emphasise their surrender. In full camouflage paint and with a bloodlust and elation of battle contorting his features, Sean cut a ferocious and terrifying figure. "Down," Sean gestured at them with a barrel of the AKM. And with transparent relief they fell face down in the dust and clasped their hands behind their heads. Just ahead, he made out the long, drooping rotors of a hind protruding above the sandbagged wall of its emplacement. "One didn't even go up," he thought as he raced towards it. And at that moment the rotors began to revolve slowly, building up speed swiftly. Somebody was attempting to start the machine. Sean darted through the narrow entrance and into the deep circular emplacement. He checked his charge for a moment to survey the interior. The hind, in its blotched camouflage, towered over him, its rotors whirling over his head as they built up to start speed on the Isotov turbo engine. Three Russian ground crew were crowded around the front of the machine, and incongruously Sean noticed the crimson arrow emblem painted on the hind's nose, which designated them an excellent crew, one of the cherished performance awards of the Soviet Air Force. The ground crew turned their white faces towards Sean and gaped at him. He jerked the muzzle of the AKM at them, and they fell back. The canopy of the weapons cockpit of the helicopter was still open, and one of the flight crew was clambering up into it. Only his plump backside in grey flying overalls protruded. Sean reached up between his legs and seized a handful of the man's genitals. The Russian squealed shrilly as Sean used them as a handle to drag him backwards and threw him against the sandbagged sidewall of the emplacement. The spinning rotors whistled shrilly as the turbo engine caught, and Sean jumped up onto the boarding step of the helicopter. The pilot's canopy was also open, and Sean thrust his AKM forward. The pilot at the controls was young and thin, with pale blonde hair cut very short. In his haste to get the hind away, he had not even donned his flying helmet. He turned his head to look at Sean. His complexion was marred by angry purple and red acne, and his eyes were very pale blue. They widened dramatically as Sean touched the tip of his acne-scarred nose with the muzzle of the AKM and said, "Party's over, Ivan. Let's go home." It was apparent that this helicopter had not been scheduled for the dawn sortie that morning, and the pilot and his crew had only begun their attempt to get the machine airborne once the attack had begun. It was less than 10 minutes since the first mortar shells had fallen into the lager. Not sufficient time, although they had almost made it. "Kill the engine," Sean told the pilot, and enforced the order by jamming the muzzle of the AKM into his nose with sufficient force to bring a smear of blood from one nostril and tears from both his pale eyes. Reluctantly, the pilot pushed the fuel mixture control to fully lean and cut both master switches. The whistle of the turbo died away. "Out," said Sean, and the pilot understood the gesture and tone, if not the word. He unclasped his safety belt and climbed down into the lager. Sean lined up the pilot, the flight engineer, and the three members of the ground crew against the sandbagged wall. "Welcome to the capitalist world, comrades," he greeted them, and then looked back at the helicopter. "Jackpot," he grinned, still euphoric, with the adrenaline in his blood. We've got ourselves a real live working hind, Matatu. Matatu was having a grand time.
Let's kill them now, he suggested merrily. Give me the banduki. Let me shoot them for you.
Sean had only seen Matatu fire one shot in his entire life, when as a joke Sean had let him fire the double .577. It had lifted Matatu clear off his feet and deposited him 10 feet away.
You couldn't hit one of them even at this range, you bloodthirsty little bugger.
Sean grinned down at him, and then once more concentrated all his attention on the hind. The magnitude of the prize he had taken began to dawn upon him. The hind would be a magnificent escape vehicle. He and Claudia, Job and Matatu could get out of here with first-class tickets, and then, with a drop of spirits, really overtook him. Sean had never flown a helicopter, didn't even have the vaguest notion of how to do so. All he knew was that it required a delicate and expert touch on the controls and was entirely different from piloting a fixed-wing aircraft. He looked back at the Russian pilot calculatingly. Despite the acne and the unprepossessing appearance, he thought he detected a stubborn and proud streak in the man's pale eyes, and he knew that the Air Force officers were amongst the elite of the Soviet armed forces. The Russian was almost certainly a fanatical patriot.
Not much chance of getting you to act as a ferry pilot, he guessed,
and then spoke aloud.
All right, gentlemen, let's get out of here.
He indicated the exit from the emplacement, and under the barrel of the AKM, they trooped towards it obediently. As the Russian pilot passed, Sean stopped him and lifted the Tokarev pistol from the holster at his hip.
You won't need that, Arvin, he said, and tucked the pistol into his own belt.
There was a fortified workshop, almost abutting the Heinz emplacement. It had been excavated into the hillside and roofed with poles and sandbags. Sean herded the Russians down into it and then looked around him. The battle had fizzled out, although there were still a few desultory shots and the pop and bang of burning ammunition. Through the drifts of smoke and dust, he saw the Shanganis of the Renamo force rounding up the prisoners and searching for loot and booty. He recognized some of the missile crews. Once the Heinz had been destroyed, they must have abandoned their stingers and rushed up the hill to join the sack of the lager. He saw one of them bayoneting a Frelimo prisoner in the buttocks and legs and roaring with laughter as the man squirmed in the dirt, kicking and contorting his body in an attempt to avoid the point of the blade. Other Renamo were emerging from the dugouts, rifles slung over their shoulders and arms full of booty. Sean was accustomed to the ethics of irregular troops in Africa. But still, this blatant indiscipline annoyed him. He snarled at them, and it was a measure of the force of his personality and the authority that he wielded over them that even in the heady moments of victory they obeyed him with alacrity. The Renamo, who had been torturing his prisoner, paused only to dispatch the maimed victim with a bullet in the back of the neck before hurrying to Sean's bidding.
"Guard these white officers," Sean ordered them. "If harm comes to them, General China will roast your testicles on a slow fire and make you eat them," he warned.
Without looking back, he strode through the lager, reasserting his command, getting his triumphant, howling, shrieking Shanganis back to sanity. He saw Sergeant Alfonso ahead of him.
"We can't carry much loot away. Let the men take their pick. And then I want limpet mines in the storerooms after everything has been drenched with avgas from the drums," he ordered Sergeant Alfonso.
Sean glanced at his wristwatch.
"We can expect Frelimo to counterattack the lager within the hour. I want to be gone by then."
"No," Alfonso shook his head.
"General China has moved 3 companies in between us to hold the Frelimo counterattack. He has ordered you to hold this position until he arrives."
Sean pulled up short and stared at Alfonso.
"What the hell are you talking about? China is 2 days' march away on the river."
Alfonso grinned and shook his head.
"General China will be here in an hour. He followed us with 5 companies of his best troops. He has never been more than an hour behind us, not since we left the river."
"How do you know this?"
Sean demanded, and Alfonso grinned again and patted the radio on the back of the trooper who stood beside him.
"I spoke to the general 10 minutes ago, as soon as we killed the last of the Russian Henshaw."
"Why didn't you tell me before this, you bastard?" Sean growled.
"The general ordered me not to, but now he has ordered me to tell you that he's very pleased with the killing of the Henshaw, and he says that you are like a son to him. When he arrives, he will reward you."
"All right," Sean changed his orders. "If we have to hold the lager, get your men into the perimeter defences. We will use the 12.7mm heavy machine guns."
Sean broke off as a Shangani trooper came running up the hill towards him.
"Nkosi,"
the man panted. And as soon as he saw his face, Sean knew it was bad news. "The woman?" he demanded, seizing the messenger's arm. "Is the white woman hurt?" The Shangani shook his head.
"She's safe. She sent me to you. It's the Matabili, Captain Job. He is hit."
"How bad?"
Sean was already starting to run, and he shouted the question over his shoulder.
"He's dying," the Shangani called after him. "The Matabili is dying."
Sean knew where to look. He had himself selected the copse of Knob Thorn Acacia as Job's attack position. The first rays of the morning sun were turning the tops of the Knob Thorns to gold as Sean ran down the hill. With the help of the two Shanganis, Claudia had moved Job onto level soft ground beneath one of the trees. She had propped his head on one of the backpacks and had a field dressing over the wound. She looked up and cried,
"Oh, Sean, thank God!"
Her shirt was drenched with drying blood, and she saw Sean's expression.
"Not my blood," she assured him. "I'm all right."
Sean transferred all his attention to Job. His face was a sickly blue-grey colour, and the flesh seemed to have melted like hot tar from his skull. Sean touched his cheek, and his skin was cold as death. Frantically, he searched for a pulse in the wrist of Job's good arm, and although it was faint and rapid, Sean's relief was intense.
"He's lost huge quantities of blood," Claudia whispered, "but I've contained the bleeding now."
"He's in shock," Sean muttered. "Let me have a look."
"Don't lift that dressing," Claudia warned him quickly. "It's ghastly. He was hit on the point of the shoulder by a cannon shell. It's just mangled flesh and bone chips, his arms hanging by a shred of muscle and sinew."
"Take Matatu with you," Sean cut in brusquely. "Go up to the lager. Find where they had their first aid post. The Russians will have a decent stock. Find it. I want plasma and a drip set. Dressings and bandages. Those are the most urgent. But if you can find antiseptic and painkillers..."
Claudia scrambled to her feet. "Sean, I was so worried about you. I saw..."
"You don't get rid of me that easy."
He didn't look up from Job's face.
"Now, off you go. Get back here as quick as you can. Matatu, go with Donna. Look after her."
The two of them went at a run. Until they returned with medical supplies, Sean was helpless. But for something to keep himself occupied, he wet his bandana from the water bottle and began to sponge the blood and dirt from Job's face. Job's eyelids fluttered open, and Sean saw that he was conscious.
"Okay, Job, I'm here. Don't try and talk."
Job closed his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them again, he swiveled them downwards, too weak to move his head. Yet he was trying to look down at his body, trying to check the extent of his injuries. It was always the first reaction.
"Is it lung blood I'm losing?"
"Are both my feet still here? Both my hands?"
"Right arm and shoulder," Sean told him. 12.7mm cannon nicked you. Just a little bitty scratch.
"You're going to make it, my lad. Written guarantee. Would I lie to you?"
A faint smile tugged up the corners of Job's mouth, and he lowered one eyelid in a conspiratorial wink. Sean felt his heart begin to break. He knew he had lied. Job wasn't going to make it.
"Relax," he ordered cheerfully. "Lie back and enjoy it," as the bishop said to the actress. "I'm in charge here now."
And Job closed his eyes. Claudia picked out the medical dugout by the Red Cross insignia at the entrance. There were two Shangani Renamo looting the interior, ransacking it for booty, but Claudia shrieked at them so violently that they slunk away guiltily. The labels on the cartons of medical supplies were all in Russian Cyrillic script. Claudia had to rip the lids open and check the contents of each. She found boxes which contained a dozen plastic bags of clear plasma each, and gave two of them to Matatu. The drip sets were on the shelf below. Field dressings and bandages were easy, but she was flummoxed by the tubes of ointments and pillboxes. However, the contents of one tube were yellow-brown and had the characteristic iodine aroma. She selected those, and then she found that some of the labels had alternative notations in French and Arabic. She had a smattering of both languages, enough to identify which were antibiotics and painkillers.